Accession number 28457, Reel 8.
Nigel Matthews, Reel 8. What was it like to experience those attacks whilst you were flying against the Japanese?
Well, an attack on any target, one's reactions are virtually the same. But in the case of attacks on the Japanese mainland, I think people were aware of two things. First of all, that they would be vulnerable to attack by suicide bombers, kamikazes, in the ships in which they were serving. And secondly, that if you were going to attack the Japanese mainland, which we were, we could expect to have some pretty intense defensive response. In fact, the Americans bore the brunt of the thing, because I think that was their wish. It was very much, the Pacific War was very much theirs. And I'm not sure that the British Pacific Fleet, though in the event it played a very valuable part in the attacks on Japan, and particularly in showing the aircraft, the Americans, the values of the ships, their ships with armored decks, which the Americans didn't have. We had a token force, only of Implacable, the only carrier on the Japanese mainland. The others having been withdrawn after the attacks on Okinawa and Iwo Jima. And so we attacked a number of airfields. We attacked a cruiser, I think, up, and this was all in the run-up to what we later discovered was the dropping of the first atomic bombs. But we were operated from about 60 to 100 miles off the coast. We would take off and fly in on the targets, attack them, and we lost a number of aeroplanes. But I was fortunate enough to escape all that sort of thing. Well, not the attacks, but certainly any injury I was free of, and my aircraft were not hit. But it was a tremendous relief afterwards, of course, when they said we were going back to Australia. And we couldn't quite understand why, but we thought the surrender was imminent. But nobody realised that there was a bomb of untold magnitude about to be dropped, and there was a signal to say that one had been dropped. And I can remember nobody really quite believing it. But then, of course, it became apparent that that was the end.
I think you said you were on your way back to Sydney when that news came through. So you had been operational against Japan in the first, certainly 1944 and 45.
That's right.
And what was your reaction to hearing that an atomic bomb had been dropped?
First of all, incredible relief. I mean, the war was over. And there is attached to that euphoria. But again, it wasn't like being ashore and celebrating V-Day or anything like that, because you were in your ship still, and so life went on as before. But there was a noticeable atmosphere of being relaxed. The tension had dropped away. And anyway, we were going back to Sydney, where, as the last arriving carrier, we were the last to return to UK. And we spent a couple of months, and we had a pretty amazing time.
I should have asked you, actually, because obviously VE Day had been and gone.
Yeah.
How was that celebrated?
Oh, well, VE Day, of course, was not really celebrated at all, I would say. But then things pass you by unless you're involved in them. I had not been in Europe, or close to the war, apart from taking the airplanes up when I was in Africa to Cairo. But on VE Day, I was actually in London, and I read the headlines, walking in Piccadilly, opposite Fortnum and Mason's, and it said invasion started.
How long were you away from the UK?
Well, in East Africa, for 18 months or more. In Implacable, about a year.
And how had you kept in contact with your family during that time?
By letters. There was an excellent fleet mail service, and they'd deliver mail when you were at sea. I mean, quite astonishing, but it was very good. And I got married before we left. We had 7 days with my wife before I departed, and then there was 18 months of no wife. But that was something that happened to water.
And what was day-to-day life like in Implacable?
Well, when the war was on, of course, it was always training. And because you were always trying to perfect and ensure that you could do what you had to do with the maximum efficiency and not get killed, or if you could avoid it, that was really the raison d'etre. But once the war ended, it was all changed. And one merely sort of lived a very normal sort of life. Bridge, chess, socialising in the bar, training. Deck hockey was a tremendous leisure activity. Ever played deck hockey? Deck hockey is a lethal game with no rules. You have a puck and you have hockey sticks, and you merely try and beat the other side on the flight deck. And there's no better place than a carrier to play deck hockey. But there are no rules.
Did you have any cinemas?
Yes. The Admiralty had I think it was called the Royal Naval Film Unit. And it had a very good library of films. And the ship would always stock up before leaving. And that, I think, goes on to today. Very much the same thing.
Where were the films shown?
Oh, in the hangar, in a carrier, because you had space there and you could see really the whole ship's company. But of course, there were always people on watch in wartime, and you didn't want to. You were in a state of watchkeeping alertness, which depending on threat, and if you were mouse from anywhere, there were no submarines about, you'd be fully relaxed. And if you were expecting to be attacked, you would be at action stations, one extreme to the other. I mean, there were various grades of alertness in between.
And what other entertainments were there on board?
Not much. Self-made. And, of course, again, while the war was on, the war. But once the war was over, what indeed? You didn't think of what we'd... I certainly didn't ever think about what life might be like back home, except that it would be nice to be free of bombs. We were only thinking back about going and having a grand old time in Australia, I think, which we did.
Did you get much shore leave whilst you were during the war?
Oh, well, the answer to that question is not a lot. While the war was on, again, there would be the occasional leave. It was given normally, unless it was for compassionate reasons, it was normally given by a ship in two stages, and the ship would go somewhere from which it could give leave. And the frequency of leave could be very small, but if the ship had to go into refit, then the opportunity was always taken to give leave so that people could get home. Well, that's about it, I think, really.
After the war, excuse me, as the war was finishing in the Pacific, you went to Sydney.
Yes.
What happened in Sydney?
Had a little bit of time, really. We went to Sydney, we went to Melbourne. We went to one or two places on the Australian coast, and we had a ball on board to say goodbye, which all the carriers did before they went. And then we went back to UK.
Who was invited to the ball?
Oh, the two Sydney. You know what that means? You know, the two Paris?
Yeah, all of Sydney.
That's right. Well, there was quite a large, a ship the size of a carrier would have the most enormous number of contacts they made. And, you know, they were always reported in the social columns of the newspaper. It was great.
Did you have much contact with the Australians, apart from the ball that you mentioned? Because
Oh, yes, they were extremely hospitable. They took us into their homes. Some people went out back and saw what the outback was like. Other people who were more town-minded sampled the tremendous hospitality that they gave us. And really, we couldn't have asked for a more gracious or kindly or enjoyable and outgoing sort of reception. Wonderful.
And did you return to the UK?
Yes. We came back in the ship. And then we had some leave to catch up from being away. And then life sort of recycled and restarted.
What was it like returning to post-war England?
It was strange, really. Because one was going back to one's home country, where everything was familiar, it was easy to be re-assimilated, as it were, into society. But there was nothing of sort of hero's welcome back or anything, certainly not when you got back as late after the war as we did. Anyway, we weren't looking for it. It was just wonderful to be home and be with one's wife again and that sort of thing. And
was there any particular reception when you arrived?
No.
Back at tour?
Well, no more than any ship now gets. But in those days, one was much more phlegmatic about receptions. You know, it was just another carrier coming in. But if you've got a thing like Implacable, which carries 2,000 people about with the air crew, the air crew would fly off somewhere, and I forget where we flew off to. But actually, we didn't. I mean, there's a little story about that, too. There was people welcomed us back, but once that was over, one was there. The one sort of crazy thing that did happen after the war was that the Avengers that we had were all on leased land. And it was a condition of leased land that when the war was over, these aircraft would be disposed of. And so we had to dispose of them by ditching them. And we shot them all off the catapult about 10 miles off Sydney. And it was very sad, really. But they were just shot off and they went to the bottom.
Who had they been leased or lent from? The Americans?
Oh, the Americans. Oh. Yes, there was a condition of the lease lent.
But they just didn't want them back?
No, they didn't. Oh, well, that's something you didn't know.
No. But you arrived back in the UK. What happened to you after that?
Well, family life sort of restarted, really. But I had decided that it seemed clear that observers would end, there would be no longer a requirement. There'd be a moratorium on observing as such. And so I didn't think that I could really go back from the Fleet Air Arm, although that was my inclination. But I didn't think that would be the sensible thing to do. I had learnt the ways of the Fleet Air Arm, which were not everybody's. And so I decided that if I could, I would become a pilot. Well, by this time, I was 25, and an Admiralty Fleet order was produced inviting people to transfer to pilots. And the cut-off point was 26. If you were 26, you couldn't do it. And so I managed to get a thing called a flying aptitude course, which I did with the RAF. And I went to a funny little place called Cliff Piped, which was a little grass airfield near Marlborough, Swindon. And I went solo, just solo once, and that was it. And then I put in for this, and they accepted me as a pilot. And so I did the pilot's course. I don't regret it at all, but the fact of the matter is that if you are a chap of 18 and you are keen to get aloft and you wish to strap an aircraft to your backside at every possible opportunity, your frame of mind is different to that of a chap of 25 who's been through it all. And so that although I became, I was told, and it's in my book, my flying logbook, an above average pilot, that was more the steadiness of maturity and the enthusiasm of youth.
Can you describe where you trained? Was that at...
Yes. It started again with an aptitude course. That's what the RAF did. And then we went to a place called Yatesbury, which is just outside Tame. Cairn, C-A-R-N. In Wiltshire, where we did EFTS, which was elementary flying training, on tiger moths. And we got through that. That was going on in the summer of 40, in the winter of 46, 47, which was the worst winter ever. It was terrible. It was bitterly cold. Coal was rationed. My wife was in London. I was in Wiltshire. Petrol was rationed, but I used to go sometimes with a pillion on a friend's motorbike and things like that. But we were busy flying. It was quite intense. And anyway, we were all keen to sort of make it, as ever. And
How were you trained? Were you...
Oh, well, the RAF had flying instructors. We had tiger moths. And you sat in the back of a tiger moth and learned how to fly.
And how long did that last?
EFTS lasted about 4 or 5 months. And then you went to OFTS, which is Operational Flying Training. And we did that at a place called Euston, which is about 10, 12 miles west of Newcastle, near Hadrian's Wall. And we flew things called Harvards, which were very good American trainers, different category to a tiger moth. And that took the best part of 6 to 9 months. And then we went to Operational Flying Training School at Lossiemouth with the Navy again. And so I took my wife to Newcastle and Euston, and that was really quite nice. I didn't know the part of the country at all, and it's a beautiful part of the country. You know it?
No, I don't know
the northeast. Oh, lovely. And it was in the shadow of Hadrian's Wall, which we explored quite a bit. But there was also some excellent fishing, and by that time I recovered my desire to fish. And then we had the problem of what to do with the family. And it seemed to us that there was every chance, as a strike pilot, that having done a bit at Lossiemouth, and deck landing training, which we did at an adjacent field called Millfield, Milltown, I would very probably find myself at near Helston at Caldrose. In the event, of course, I didn't. There was an attempt was made to, I made an attempt to get myself on loan to the Australians. That didn't work. And the next thing I knew, I was in the Med. Very short notice when my wife joined me after about 6 weeks. Now back to the sort of sequence of flying training. It's a thing about flying is that as you move up from one aircraft to another, the new aeroplane, when you first see it, seems to be huge. It's always, it is bigger, but it just, you get an impression of an enormously powerful beast that you've got to master. And anyway, that was a particular reaction of going from Harvards to flying fireflies, which is what we had in Lossiemouth. And then at the end of the EFTS, the OFTS, which was more advanced flying, formation flying, and that sort of thing, we did direct landing training, and that took a month. And you did these things called ADLs, which are aircraft deck, down deck landings, and round and round, rounding circuits and bumps, landing on, going round again, each air under the control of a batsman, and then eventually winding up with doing three deck landings in, I forget what the carrier was, I think it was Triumph, but they sent a carrier up and we did some deck landings on that. Very exciting. Very, very exciting.
That's very scary, the first one.
Very scary. Yeah. It's in an Avenger. Avenger had a nice round radial engine. You can actually see over the top because the front of the fuselage slopes down the engine and the cockpit's up here. But in a British aircraft, released at the time, Fireflies, and not in a jet, of course, because it's all behind you, and you can see beautifully. But in Firefly, you have this enormous, monstrous Rolls-Royce Griffon engine, which sits up in front of you. And the aircraft, when it's going slowly, has to come around with its nose in the air, or it can't go slow enough. So you've got to come around in a curve all the time to see, and just straighten up at the end. But it is a fact that if, when you have straightened up, you cannot see the deck. You only see the edges of the deck about here, not there, because you're like that and the nose is up in front of you. So there is a sort of, God bless me, you know, I'm in the hands of God now, every time you do it. But after a bit, it's like everything else. It's like driving a car. A, you don't forget. You need to keep in practice. And B, you do get used to it and you get quite good at it. And, well, there we are. That's pilot training for you.
And what about takeoffs?
Oh, takeoffs, there's no problem at all. I mean, you just push the throttle forward, the tail comes up, and you drive down the airway, down the runway, and then ease back on the pearl.
What happened after you'd completed your training?
After Lossiemouth, I endeavoured to go to Australia on there. Didn't work. And then they said, you're going to Malta to join Triumph. And so I did that at very short notice, and I joined Triumph in the Mediterranean. By that time, peacetime routine for carriers in the Mediterranean fleet had been established, and Triumph was one of the light fleet carriers. She was a small carrier, run by an ace ship handler called Conley Abel Smith, who afterwards became Admiral of the Royal Yacht, it was a very, very happy ship, but she was well down a commission when I joined, and so one had to prove oneself in order to be accepted, and I was successful in doing that, and we had we were really suddenly back to naval peacetime existence. You know, it was exercising quite a lot of flying, based in Malta at Halfar, the shore-based aircraft airbase out on near in one corner of the island, and then one embarked for cruises, and you went to Anzio for Rome and Salerno for Florence, and so it went on, and then the ship came back to recommission.
Before we move on, just ask you a bit more about that time.
Yeah.
You were shore-based, presumably, most of the time.
Yes.
And what did you do?
Flew. All the time flying. Flying every day. And one was, of course, a make-your-own pilot, just out of flight training. So there was a lot of training to be done. Formation flying, follow my leader, firing rockets, dropping bombs, and that sort of thing. And there were excellent facilities, of course, in Malta for all that, and the weather was lovely.
And what rank were you by this stage?
I was I was what are we talking about now? 26, 27. I was not quite a lieutenant commander. I was a lieutenant still.
And
I'd been an acting lieutenant commander in Implacable, because what I didn't mention before was that I had been made ship's operations officer after the war in Japan, because the previous incumbent had been sent home because his time was up.
One thing I think we failed to mention, that you were decorated after the war.
Well, the most saddest feature of my decoration was that I never got decorated, because at the end of the war, there were so many chaps queuing up and other demands were being made on His Majesty that I was one of those who didn't get decorated. We just got the Medal for the Post. Rather sad, really.
And can you describe which medal that was?
It was a Distinguished Service Cross.
And what was that for?
Well, I don't know precisely what it was for. The precise wording of the citation escapes me now, but I believe it was probably centred around that day when I fell off the front and flew again the same evening and endeavoured to inspire my observers that perhaps one had to get on with the job. But obviously it was something which, it was a whole record. It was flying off the Norwegian coast. It was strikes on Japan. It was everything.
We digress slightly there, but Malta, when you were cruising, what sort of work did you do then? What sort of training?
Oh, well, the training on the way, when one was going from place to place, the carrier was always going as part of the fleet. It might be going with just a destroyer for sea rescue, but generally it was with some major units of the fleet somewhere. And there would be a visit, and you would exercise, like Bellio, with a sort of pattern of operational flying that you had in the war, except you weren't actually attacking anything. There was quite a lot of low-level flying, which you didn't do much of in the war, which was very exciting. It kept on telling you to get lower when you were about 50 feet. And then, of course, when you got to the place one was visiting, you know, it was like any other navy officer these days. People really, at that time, there was an enormous sort of respect and affection, I think, for those who were still serving. And anyway, the Navy was held in great affection around the Med. And wherever one went, one got extremely well looked after.
And how long were you with HMS Triumph?
I was with Triumph for about 18 months, because after the first 6 months in Malta, we went home to recommission. And those people who had come last to the ship, of which I was one, remained in the ship to recommission. And I was left with a squadron, and we had a new CO, and we went back to the Med because that was the station where we were, and my wife was left in Malta until we went back. But then Korea started, and after a time we suddenly went out to the Far East. But I was by this time fairly senior in age and getting more experience as a pilot. And there were slight problems in the ship with leadership problems of the squadrons. And as a result of that, the air group commander was relieved. Not badly, but you know, he was relieved, and the squadron commander moved up one, and I became the squadron commander. And we did some operations over the Malaysian jungle from Singapore, but I never participated in Korea because I went home in order to do, I think, a staff course or something, and another appointment, because I'd done my time in the ship, and it was normally sort of 18 months to 2 years.